Good morning, everyone. Another beautiful day here at Sea to Sky. Have you been listening to the birds?
Yeah. 4:30.
Yeah.
Those robins, who needs an alarm clock? But there are others. I love coming here because there are ones I don't know. And they're hiding up in the trees. I can't see them. They're these little riddles. Who is that? I know quite a few bird calls, but all you have to do is go out of your, you know, your neighborhood and you start hearing different ones. So I have a story from Andrea Olson. Today we're going to talk about finding our voices, healing our voices. And here's her story. When I was teaching in Vermont, I would get raging sore throats 2 or 3 times a year, which would turn into coughs, colds, and go away after a few weeks of misery. Although I feel articulate in movement and writing, speaking feelings directly was difficult for me. Remember the description of her childhood from yesterday? During one such bout, speaking feelings directly was difficult for me, the strain registered in my throat. During one such bout, I was walking in a field filled with crows. I was frustrated, and their cawing was relentless. I began cawing back, imitating their sound and enjoying the feeling it created in my body. My sore throat went away. After this, when I started my sore throat routine, I would, timidly at first, reply with my crow calls. Perhaps the vibrations loosen the tissues or the unexpressed feelings get released by the sound. Whatever the cause, my sore throats have gone.
Aha!
Try it. What a flock. But do you feel that? Feel an opening in the throat? Yeah, yeah. You notice, you know, go out there. Answer the next crow you hear out there. Just let her rip. And feel that in your throat. Isn't that interesting? So today I just have gathered so much rich material that I probably won't have time to share it with you all, but there's so much I want to share with you. And there are different voices from women working with voice, and so the voice poets, therapists, voice, particularly voice therapists, even one painter, George O'Keefe. So I've clustered these under some general topics, and starting with healing and voice work, and then truth telling, fear, connection, and beyond words. So I'll see how far I get. A man named Alfred Wolfson was a pioneer in voice therapy, really working with the voice directly. And he called the voice the muscle of the soul. Isn't that I wonder, you know, the eyes are called the windows of the soul. The voice, the muscle of the soul. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we feel that, the way that our voice constrict and open, just like, because there are muscles, right, controlling that whole, Andrea Olson's book, she gives a very detailed anatomy of the voice. It's quite interesting. But given that the voice is the muscle of the soul, no wonder when we need to protect ourselves, we hide behind soft, sweet, diffident voices and don't use our full voices. This lovely little anthology I found somewhere called Well-Tuned Women, Growing Strong Through Voice Work. And it's from the UK. a lot of women who have worked with voice in different ways in the UK. And the first one gives a kind of history of women and voice. She calls it Snapshots from a Vocal History, because she weaves her own vocal history in too. Joan Mills is her name. And she touches on different times in history, and I can't, you know, go through it all, but when women's voices have been suppressed and constricted, and other times less so. In many times in history and different cultures, but certainly not all, she says women, like children, were to be seen and not heard. It was somehow unwomanly to speak in public and be witty and entertaining. That was all in the male sphere. Well, and yet, a woman could be entertaining and witty if she were not a wife, right? The role of the courtesan, you know, the geisha, the very skilled conversationalist and a performer. But that's a different role. Wives weren't supposed to do that. That or acting. Of course, you know, acting is another, you know, for many years, women on stage were associated with would be labeled as loose women. But in folk culture, actually women's voices are stronger in folk cultures, not high culture. And she talks about the folk traditions of storytelling, of lullabies, singing lullabies, right? Creating new verses to old songs. That's folk culture. And she talks about and singing being part of the yearly round of agricultural festivals and the seasons. And women were always in on that, often central to that. And she said the Industrial Revolution, the coming of radio and later television, meant the loss of many of those traditions and those old songs. But there have been work done by ethnomusicologists collecting those songs, and she cites one woman who went and collected songs in the Hebrides Islands, which is, you know, Celtic tradition, and she found death croons, originally sung over the dying to ease their passage to death by women who were very often also midwives and had equally helped many into life. And I tried to, I was Googling around trying to see if I found one, but no words, it was just a notation. And I'm gonna dig around some more. And what's really interesting is in the 20th and now 21st century growth of end-of-life care and hospice care, there's now a widespread movement of what are called death doulas, mm-hmm. who are kind of death coaches in the way a midwife is, but there's a Chalice of Repose school which teaches people to play the harp and sing solo. But I'm thinking also of a much more widespread, and they're called, it'll come back to me if I stop trying. They're choirs, they're small choirs, usually only about, and they sing at the bedside. There's several groups in Vancouver, there's one on the Sunshine Coast, and they have a repertoire of really lovely songs. And I was at a little conference. I was invited to come and talk about Buddhist perspectives on chant and at end of life, and it was at Vancouver School of Theology, and one of these choirs came and presented, and I got to be the demonstration dying person, and they had a reclining chair, and I laid there, and they sang around me, and it was really a wonderful feeling. When I used to work for Mission Hospice Society for a short time, we formed a choir and did some of that, and we weren't formally, yeah. So this is a tradition that's actually reviving, and women, for the most part, are involved. Yeah. Another really interesting thing from this section is where she talks about the kind of advice women were given in popular culture, magazines, in around the 40s and 50s about how to attract men and keep them. And one was a magazine series called Glorify Yourself. And it was hints from the stars, right? And here's a quote. Nothing so enhances a person's charm as does a colorful yet gracious manner of speech. Good conversation can make you more popular. Now it says, in order to improve her speech technique, the woman of 1948 was advised to practice a variety of vocal exercises in front of a mirror and repeat words which might prove tricky. Why tricky? Because she had to be sure when pronouncing such words as vacant or vanity or friend, not to let the front teeth touch the lower lip and thus transfer lipstick to the teeth. Okay. The result is a slightly pouting mode of speech which can be observed in films of that era. So watch next time. You know how sometimes it feels like they're, why are they talking like that? Yeah. Well, they don't want to get lipstick on their teeth. Also, this series gave advice on how to turn in a doorway and the social pivot. You know, how to turn. Posture was considered particularly important and required the reader to learn to walk in high-heeled shoes along a chalk line, holding the abdominal muscles in and raising the chest. Quote, as your buttock muscles tighten, when you push your coccyx forward, do you notice that your abdominal muscles contract also? They do, and your abdomen looks flatter. And now we're back to the writer. She says, I've met many women around my age who still carry themselves with this kind of postural combination and cannot release the abdominal muscles or manage abdominal breathing methods because they have been sucking it in so long. And how does that affect the voice?
And breathing in general.
And breathing in general, yeah. Yeah.
So we're not supposed to do that?
Yeah. No woman.
My mom taught me.
See? It gets passed on. Right? And Roshi Jones Halifax, who some of you know, teaches strong back, soft belly, soft front. Soft and open, and strong spine holding us up. Yeah. So, experiment with that a little. Also a few words from an American, really well-known American voice teacher, Kristen Linklater, who says, most people think that the quality of their voice is genetically and anatomically predetermined. But nurture and culture are, in fact, the major determinants of vocal quality and vocal behavior. The cultural rules women unconsciously obey are that their voices should be high and helpless or low and gentle. If women's voices are low and strong, they break balls. If their voices are high and strong, they're shrill, right? And so we can be, you know, high and soft or low and soft. And so many women speak lower or higher than their actual natural true voice range is, surprisingly. The deeper ranges of the voice connect with the self at a fundamental level of power, and many women avoid the feeling and expression of power because they do not want to dominate. Power has a bad history. True enough. It is possible that if women's voices were free, they could transform the reputation of power from despotic to an articulation of powerful gentleness, powerful caring, powerful joy, powerful laughter, and powerful vulnerability that is the prerequisite for powerful compassion. I just love finding Dharma in non-Dharma sources, you know? There it is. Could have been a Dharma teacher. Threshold choirs. Threshold choirs. That's the movement, and it's spread. It's you know, national in the U.S. and Canada. Another thing. This is again from Kristen Linklater. She says, "We women must surely acknowledge that we have been rigorously trained in the art of prevarication." Everybody know that word? It means we have been raised to dodge the issue, to be vocally and verbally devious for the sake of peace and quiet in our society and our families. Primarily our families, that's where we learned first. We become liars, and it is women who teach us how. So, that's a segue.
Prevarication.
Yeah, it's a kind of roundaboutness, you know, avoidance of directness. Yeah.
But isn't that also culturally defined?
Pardon me?
Yeah.
Well, there, as you know, in Japanese culture, it's very polite and proper to not be direct.
Yeah, and it's a very hierarchical society. Mm-hmm. And as that hierarchy, you know, because you have to always be gauging your relative relationship to others. And as that breaks down and as societies become more diverse, there's a need, even in Japan, there's more direct speech as people moved from isolated countryside locations post-war to the city to find work. And if you go to Hokkaido, the northernmost island where people migrated in the 20th century, their ordinary discourse is much more relaxed than in Kyoto, mm-hmm. where you have to be very careful to be, you know, gauging how polite to be. Yeah, so it changes. You know, again, culture, right?
And sometimes it can be dangerous. I mean, when I've been to India many times, and a woman said something that she wasn't to speak.
Sure, that's...
A man or her brother or her brother-in-law has the right to throw acid on her. That kind of stuff.
Yeah, so this is what we have to, you know, look at all these, you know, cultural and social factors in voice. So that brings us, that sort of segues into my next little theme, which is truth-telling. Right? It's one of the greatest challenges in reclaiming our voices is the difficulty of expressing the truth in our lives. You know, we learn in Buddhist teaching that there is no absolute truth, that everything in the phenomenal world is impermanent and has no fixed self-nature, right? So how do you tell the truth about anything? We and everything else exist only in continuously changing interconnection with all other phenomena. So we have to recognize that many of the things we think of as truths are provisional and relative and not true to someone else, or not true at another time. And yet, we do have, in the relative world, relative truth. I mean, there's still, it doesn't mean that that everything, it doesn't mean that we can't exercise what's called discriminating wisdom around what has happened. And there are times when we must express the truth of our lives, relative as it may be, with as much authenticity as we can, and a measure of humility to know that we never know the whole truth. You know, the poet Muriel Rukeyser once said, if one woman told the truth of her life, the world would split open. You know, it's kind of that big, because even our personal truth, of course, is connected to everything. So what truth? Yeah, how often we fudge the truth of our lives, hold back just a little or quite a lot, modifying it to be more acceptable to our listeners, or obeying one or the other prescription not to tell. How often do we not tell the truth in our relationships with men or with each other? The great American poet Adrienne Rich wrote an essay. Well, she wrote a book of essays called "On Lies, Truth and Silence."
Secrets.
That's right. Lies, secrets, and silence. And I couldn't find my copy, so I had to get some excerpts. And what she says. She says, lying is done with words and also with silence. You know, not telling is a kind of lie. There is no the truth or a truth. Truth is not one thing or even a system. It is an increasing complexity. I like that. You know. This is why the effort to speak honestly is so important. Lies are usually attempts to make everything simpler for the liar than it really is or ought to be. So lies oversimplify, usually. She says, in lying to others, we end up lying to ourselves. We deny the importance of an event or a person and thus deprive ourselves of a part of our lives. Or we use one piece of the past or present to screen out another. Thus we lose faith even within our own lives. Because we've split off. And this is also, you could reword this to apply to what it's like being lied to, when someone lies to us. It splits off a part of the truth. And then she says, the unconscious wants truth, as the body does. The complicity and fecundity is fertility, right? The complicity and fecundity of dreams comes from the... Oh, sorry, I read that wrong. The complexity and fecundity of dreams comes from the complexity and fecundity of the unconscious struggling to fulfill that desire for truth. Does that make sense? Yeah, dreams are, you know, the unconscious. Not all dreams, but, you know, you've had dreams that you feel like this dream is trying to tell me something, you know. Yeah, so the unconscious, she says, is reaching for truth. And then, so how do we begin to know our own experience? Because when that kind of denial, we start to be uncertain of our own experience, not confident in our own experience. How do we begin to know it and give it words and make then careful and appropriate choices about when and to whom we express ourselves? Doesn't mean we just, you know, spill all over the... we still have to use speech carefully and appropriately. So, Susan Griffin, here's the book I told you about, A Chorus of Stones, highly recommended. I'll just read you a few little passages from her. How old is the habit of denial? We keep secrets from ourselves that all along we know. The public was told that old Dresden was bombed to terrible firebombing in Dresden, right? World War II, towards the end. The public was told that Dresden was bombed to destroy strategic railway lines. There were no railway lines in that part of the city. But it would be years before that story came to the surface. Does this sound familiar? Weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? I do not see my life as separate from history. In my mind, my family secrets mingle with the secrets of statesmen and bombers, nor is my life divided from the lives of others. I, who am a woman, have my father's face, and he, I suspect, had his mother's face. And she talks about, there's family history about her father, you know, in the war. And she says, the military mind shies clear of a certain kind of knowledge. And just as in our imagination of public events, we banish what we call private life to the background of our telling. The soldier excludes particular feelings and memories from his idea of who he is. I am thinking now of my father, how well he learned neither to speak nor to think about his mother, yet the thought must have been perpetually at the back of his mind, in that place that escapes apprehension. He had a sorrow that he himself could not explain. So again, you know, she's talking about those generational silencings. Nowhere is there a record of all that has happened in human history, except in living consciousness. And does the truth each of us knows die along with us unless we speak it? This we cannot know. Only we know that the consequences of every act continue and themselves cause other consequences until a later generation will accept the circumstances created by of these acts as inevitable. Unless instead this generation tries to unravel the mystery, and if they penetrate the secret whose scent persists in all eventualities, will they say finally, this death, this wound, this suffering was not necessary? So again, she's talking about karma, isn't she? And that we each, in each generation, take responsibility for purifying karma in whatever small ways we can, right? But, and that carries forward, that carries forward. To enter history through childhood experience shifts one's perspective not away from history, but instead to an earlier time just before history has finally shaped us. Is there a child who existed before the conventional history that we tell ourselves? One who, though invisible to us, still shapes events even through this absence? That child we were. Was there a child? This is like a koan. This is like asking about your original face. Mm-hmm. Was there a self before the influences? Well, we were influenced in our mother's wombs, right? Mm-hmm. You know. Yeah. So in a way, you're looking for something that. But she's saying, imagine back. How does our sense of history change when we consider childhood? And perhaps more important, why is it that until now we have chosen to ignore this point of origination, the birthplace and womb of ourselves, in our consideration of public events, right? We somehow separate the personal and private from the public, which is actually not the case. Yeah, so that gives you the flavor of some of what her exploration is. And maybe some perspective on a more spacious, deeper and wider story of our own lives. Okay, one more, because I love her writing so much. I have come to believe that every life bears in some way on every other. The motion of cause and effect is like the motion of a wave in water, continuous, within and not without the matrix of being, so that all consequences, whether we know them or not, are intimately embedded in our experience. But the missile, as it hurls towards its target, has lost its context. It has been driven farther than the eye can see. How can one speak of direction any longer? Nothing in the space the missile passes through can seem familiar. In the process of flight, alienated by terror, this motion has become estranged from life, has fallen out of the natural rhythm of events. It just strikes me that she wrote this before. This would have been 1982, yeah. What are those called? Missiles that are remotely guided?
Drones.
Thank you, drones. Even one more step removed, and yet the drone operator sees it, sees the child beside the house where the suicide bombers' ammo is, bombs are stored. And it's known now that the drone operators experience every bit as strong PTSD as actually more so than the one who drops the bomb from far, far above, because they are actually, although they're many thousand miles away, they see on the screen the actual child.
Golly, that's so sad.
So Susan Griffin does a masterful job, I think, of showing us how this way that our personal stories are stories of humanity, inextricably interwoven. And it is a healing. It's painful. It's deep and painful work, but it's a healing work to explore and make those strands visible. Make those strands visible and audible, heard, to tell those stories. So we come up against fear. You know, fear is what silence is, pretty much the core of silencing, isn't it? And so we have to be acquainted with fear. Audre Lorde, African-American woman, poet, essayist, activist, wrote this in around 1977. It was a speech she gave. That's a long time ago. Some of you weren't born. Some of us were much younger.
Yeah.
And she wrote a speech called "The Transformation of Silence into Language and Action." And this is part of what she said. What are the words you do not yet have? What do you need to say? What are the tyrannies you swallow day by day and attempt to make your own until you will sicken and die of them, still in silence? In the cause of silence, each of us draws the face of her own fear, fear of contempt, of censure, of some judgment, or recognition, of challenge, of annihilation, all those things we fear, right? But most of all, I think we fear the visibility without which we cannot truly live. In a sense, we fear what we most yearn for. We can sit in our corners mute forever while our sisters and ourselves are wasted, while our children are distorted and destroyed, while our earth is poisoned. We can sit in our safe corners mute as bottles, and we will still be no less afraid. We can learn to work and speak when we are afraid, in the same way we have learned to work and speak when we are tired. For we have been socialized to respect fear more than our own needs for language and definition, and while we wait in silence for that final luxury of fearlessness, the weight of that silence will choke us. The fact that we are here and that I speak these words is an attempt to break that silence and bridge some of those differences between us. For it is not difference which immobilizes us, but silence. And there are so many silences to be broken. She was a great orator, you know, in that African-American tradition. You know, she just put it out there. Amazing woman, I think, now too much forgotten. Audre Lorde. So how do we speak and act even with our fear? How do we become so acquainted and befriend our fear? How can we stand alongside our fear in friendship so that we can not wait for that ultimate fearlessness? I remember when I was young and I had lived out on my organic farm in Maritime Canada for about 7 years, and I ventured out into the big city and I started doing Aikido. And I had a lot of fear. I didn't know how to function in a city. Aikido, this is so great. I would always come out feeling really grounded and, you know, strong and clear. I thought, wow, if I go do this really intensively for about a year, I'll be fearless. No. Same with Zen practice. it's lifelong. It's lifelong, that befriending of fear and coming alongside fear. Because, you know, our world has a lot to be frightened of. And we know, and then we meet others who are frightened. We're around others who are frightened. There's a lot of denied fear in our culture right now around climate change. A lot of people distracting themselves and because it's just too scary to think about, right? So we need to have that capacity to not be afraid of fear, to be okay with fear. Georgia O'Keeffe, my great American artist, her biographer, Roxana Robinson, wrote in the biography, "Imagination is integral to courage. Imagination is integral to courage. The sensibility that imagines no risks does not knowingly take any. And there is no bravery in a landscape without danger." George's enormously powerful imaginative capabilities resulted in a greater capacity for fear of every sort. But the experience was always worth the risk. And then quoting Georgie O'Keeffe, she said, "I'm frightened all the time, scared to death, but I've never let it stop me, never." Yeah. But I love that imagination is integral to courage. Our teacher, Norman Fisher, has just come out with a new book, and I'm not going to get the title right, so somebody help me if you can remember it exactly, but it's Imagination.
Isn't it Things Could Be Different?
That's the subtitle.
Oh, okay.
Or Things Could Be Different is the title. And imagination and something. Anyway, but and it's about the role that imagination plays in particularly living the paramitas, you know, generosity, conduct, yeah, anyway, the paramitas. So again, another book exploring this territory of imagination, I think would be worth our attention. So, fear. One way to practice with fear is to practice in connection, in community, making connections. And so I want to just touch on some words of some women who work in connection as therapists or healers in certain ways. Who in here would generally classify themselves as a sort of on the introverted side of the spectrum?
The what?
Introverted side of the spectrum, as you know, past the extrovert, extreme extroverts are over here, and you know, so if you're past the halfway point on the introvert side, most of us are somewhere in the middle. But yeah, you know. Meditation tends to attract people who are somewhat on the introverted side. So you might really like this book. This is a just delightful anthology out of obscure, you know, University of Alberta Press. But there are a lot of, you know, Canadian writers called Shy. There's a little shy dog on the front. See him? But this article I really was taken by a woman who it's on shyness and stuttering. And talks about her schooling and how shy she was. And an encounter where with a friend who turned to her and very scornfully said, "Why are you always stuttering?" And she says, "I've always been shy, but I didn't and don't consider myself a person who stutters. When I was younger, however, I often had the sensation of tightness in my chest, of squeezing out the last words of a sentence. These breathing problems happened when I had to read aloud or answer a question in class, and especially when I had to give a presentation." Anybody get nervous when you had to make public? There's something really primal. Something really primal about standing in front of a group. You know, you're so exposed. I think it goes, you know, back to a really early time in our human history, you know, where those arrows were going to come flying. it's something, I think it's very deep. Fear of public speaking is right up in the top five of fears. She became a speech therapist and worked with, became actually an expert in stuttering. She quotes the actor James Earl Jones, you know, famous, very distinguished.
Darth Vader.
Yeah, but also Shakespearean stage actor. Like, he's got incredible range. And if you know him, you know his voice, right? And he had a terrible stutter in childhood. And he said this: "I think a stutterer ends up with a greater need to express himself, or perhaps a greater awareness of the deep human need for expression. Being a stutterer leaves you painfully aware of how you would like to say something. And I would know, as an afterthought, how I could have said this or that. But at the moment, you are too busy making the choice to speak or not to speak, to use this word or that word. The pain is in the reflection. The desire to speak builds and builds until it becomes part of your energy, your life force. But when I was a boy, speech became a wall I could not surmount." This push-pull, needing to speak, being afraid to speak. And that, I think, many of us, whether we have ever stuttered or not, we can relate to. Yeah? We can relate to that. That push-pull. So she says, sometimes my clients tell me that they want to speak perfectly like normal speakers. I understand the sentiment. If only I could write perfectly like this or that author. But I tell them that no one has perfect fluency. We all repeat, revise, say and ah, and hem and haw. I tell them that perfect fluency can sound memorized, glib, insincere, like this. I'll skip on, yeah. So it's sort of like that was Zen practice too. We all slip and flub and space out now and then and forget things, you know, forget a bow or this or that. And there's kind of a kind of tenderness and loveliness about the our not perfect practice. And if it is too perfect, there's something, it loses a stiffness, there's a mechanicalness.
The lotus can't grow.
The lotus can't grow. We need the mud. You got it.
Thank God she brought her bag with her. It's written on her bag.
Oh, right. About the lotus. Yeah. So this is... Yeah, I've got time. I'm going to go a little further with this. This is the Georgia O'Keeffe quote that I just gave you.
Right underneath Shah.
Thank you. These are two of my favorite books by women who did studies on women and kind of self-expression. This one's called Singing at the Top of Our Lungs, Women, Love, and Creativity. And it's about sort of what impedes women's full expression, and you know why women pull back from particularly creative work, and trade that some often the trade-offs between love of partner or children and what's called self-expression, which then becomes selfish to do, right? Really interesting study. Both these books are based on really deep interviewing. They're not recent, but it was a time when I was doing a lot of reading in this area, so this one was 93. So you can tell these are kind of similar times. And this one's called Meeting at the Crossroads, about the turning points in girls' and women's lives. They did extensive interviews with girls from grade school to pre-adolescence to adolescence, looking at voice. And they say, voice is central to our way of working, our channel of connection, a pathway that brings the inner psychic world of feelings and thoughts out into the open air of relationship, where it can be heard by oneself and other people. The physicality of voice, its sounds, resonances, vibrations, gives our voice, our work, its naturalistic grounding, and the resounding by girls of voices that may have been muted or covered over by women is a key to the physics of relationship and the relational nature of our psychological work. So they're really looking at these voices, girls' voices, and how they express themselves. And they would use these questions to attune their ear to listening carefully. Who is speaking? In what body? Telling what story about relationship? From whose perspective or from what vantage point? In what societal and cultural frameworks? So a very, different way of working from maybe previous types of psychological research. What they discovered was that girls in the 7-8-year-old range, who knows, that might be changing by now, so a couple decades later, but what they observed was, I'm quoting now, a willingness to speak out to those with whom they are in relationship about bad or hurt feelings, anger, resentment, or frustration, as well as feelings of love, fondness, and loyalty. These 7 and 8-year-old girls say matter-of-factly that people are different, that they may disagree, and as a result, sometimes people get hurt. While they speak about the importance of being nice, they openly acknowledge that sometimes they do not feel like being nice, and they know that they can be hurt, that they can hurt others, and they speak about being hurt by others. In this sense, their relationships seem genuine or authentic. And then they move just a few years later, 10, 11, approaching closer to adolescence, and they find a change. They say, when it is wrong to know what is happening or to express strong feelings, and when, conversely, everyone is called a friend and everyone is said to care, girls struggle to stay in touch with what they're experiencing so that they can tell the difference between genuine and false or idealized relationships. So it becomes much more fraught and confusing. It's a relational kind of landmine. As girls enter relationship, and their voices become muted, the imperative to be nice becomes stronger. Over and over in their interviews, we hear these girls struggle as their strong feelings come up against a relational impasse that shuts out their experience or shuts down their loud voices, a wall of shoulds in which approval is associated with their silence, love with selflessness, and relationship with lack of conflict. Yeah. Now, you could speculate that, you know, social media has it says a sense of relational treachery is everywhere in this age. And so, you know, social media has maybe made it even more treacherous. Even more treacherous, huh? Yeah. But then what they saw, here's an interesting thing. What they saw as time went on, as they, as the girls grew older, that, because they followed these girls over a span of years, that the actual engagement with these women and these conversations brought the girls into a kind of self-reflection, and because they had a venue to do that with these women. And so their voices, as they came into later adolescence, had, you know, a much more self-reflection and confidence in some cases. And particularly, they said that this was stronger, not for the girls who had the more perfectionist tendencies and presentation, but for the girls who the girls in our study, it says, who because of color or class lived in the margins. The girls who were so clearly at odds with the dominant models of female beauty and perspective as to reveal the cultural hand behind the standards, these girls often spoke in loud voices, and among them we found many of our staunchest resistors, because they knew what they were pushing back against, you know. And they also tended to have close, confiding relationships with their mothers, relationships in which both mother and daughter speak, and where they engage in open conflict, give voice to their feelings of anger and sadness, where both mother and daughter can feel the power they have to affect one another, and thus the depths of their connection and love. So that gives you a little bit of flavor of this kind of work. And the importance of cross-generational connection, because of course youth culture can be isolated, and even young adult culture can be isolated from later, you know, and seniors are in senior enclaves with golf courses, right? And so there's a generational disconnect. So these kind of connections are important for coming to authentic speech. Then, of course, we recognize the limits of words. French writer Hélène Sissou, I think. The most beautiful words cannot be written, unfortunately. Fortunately. We would have to be able to write with our eyes, with wild eyes, with the tears of our eyes, with the frenzy of a gaze, with the skin of our hands. Isn't that beautiful? So we speak with our hands and with our materials as well. Terry Tempest Williams, you want me to make up a little selection of some of these quotes so you can take some time with them? I'm giving you a lot. I can do that. I can cut and paste and make a little document, send out to you. Some of these are so good. Terry Tempest Williams, who I told you about yesterday and read about her mother's journals, at the end of this book, of her reflections, and her own on her own development as a writer as well, she says, "I realize that I will never be able to say what is in my heart because words fail us, because it is in our nature to protect, because there are times when what is public and what is private must be discerned. There is comfort in keeping what is sacred inside us, not as a secret, but as a prayer." Mm. The world is already split open, and it is our destiny to heal it, each in our own way, each in our own time, and with the gifts that are ours. Yeah. I'll mail that one out to you.
And the previous one.
Oh, yeah. I'll collect them. Yeah. So that's what I meant. We use discernment in when and to whom and what we say. But isn't that, you know, keeping what is sacred inside, not as a secret, but as a prayer sometimes. So we can do that as well. Ivan Boland, is an Irish poet, wrote a long visionary poem called The Journey. It begins with the poet sitting in her messy study one evening, listening for the sounds from her sleeping children, full of angry despair at the utility of poetry. What's the use? She was in a what's the use moment in the face of the terrible illness. Her children were ill, or one was at least. And in the poem, she drifts into a dream state in which the ancient Greek poet Sappho appears to her and takes her on a descent into the underworld, where she finds women lovingly carrying children who have died of the many great plagues of history. Cholera, typhus, remember, you know, when women would have 15 children and maybe 5 would survive. She would feel fortunate if 5 survived. Typhus, croup, diphtheria. And Sappho becomes her guide and interpreter through this underworld. It reminds me of the story of, you know, Jizo Bodhisattva in the Doksan room. That's Jizo on the altar. We'll bring Jizo up here this evening. And that's a female Jizo, please, in the Doksan room. Jizo is the Bodhisattva who the legend is that she travels down to the underworld to save children who have died or been miscarried or aborted, stillborn, or died too young. So this is similar. Sappho has taken the poet into this underworld. But the poet cannot speak or touch these women or children on the other side of the river of dream. And this is how the poem concludes. I whispered, "Let me be, let me at least be their witness." But she said, "What you have seen is beyond speech, beyond song, only not beyond love. Remember it, you will remember it." And I heard her say, but she was fading fast as we emerged under the stars of heaven. "There are not many of us. You are dear and stand beside me as my own daughter. I have brought you here so you will know forever the silences in which are our beginnings, in which we have an origin like water." So we take those journeys, those imaginary journeys sometimes into the underworld of dream, in the unconscious, into our origins. And then we come back and we sing our songs and offer them up. So I will stop there.